Listen, I used to live in a country where in the summer it was like 125 degrees on the regular. Like, swamp butt is not fun. You don't want to sit outside. And, you know, at Applebee's, it's not a pleasant experience.
Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. A slew of high-quality polling released last week shows an increasingly dire picture for President Trump. We knew already that Biden had a large lead nationally, but polls of individual battleground states are now showing Biden up by a healthy margin in every swing state and essentially tied in Georgia and Texas. So what's gone wrong for Trump? Is this a low watermark for him, or is the bottom really falling out here? Also, the COVID-19 outbreaks across the South and Southwest have continued to worsen, with Florida and Texas becoming the first states to reimpose restrictions. So why are these outbreaks happening now, and how are politicians responding? We'll get to all of that. And here with me to discuss, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Galen.
Also here with us is senior politics writer Claire Malone. Hey, Claire.
Hi, Galen.
And senior politics writer Perry Beacon Jr. Hey, Perry.
Good to see you, Galen.
So let's begin with these recent COVID outbreaks. According to the New York Times, the number of new coronavirus cases is up 76% in the U.S. over the past 2 weeks. There are reports of strained hospital capacity or the potential for a strain on resources across a number of states in the South. So, Nate, I just want to start by asking, in comparison to what we were all experiencing in the Northeast in March and April, how bad are these outbreaks in the South? Has it gotten to the point where we were here in New York yet?
They're pretty bad, but there are three important differences. Number one is that we have much more testing capacity right now than we had back in March. It may not be enough, right? It seems like in a lot of these states, you don't have enough testing to handle the overflow capacity. But still, it might be the case that, you know, you're doing somewhere on the order of five times as many tests than you were back in kind of late March, early April. So that makes a difference. Number two, the spread seems to be among different people. It seems to be primarily among younger people who have been doing a variety of things, going out and socializing, going to work. I don't know if we want to get into the protests, but that was also concentrated among young people. There's a lot of debate about what effect, if any, that had. But it's much younger. And third, perhaps related to that, and perhaps not, so far we have not really seen much of an increase in death rates. In fact, the number yesterday, Sundays are usually very slow for reporting, but it was the lowest number of deaths reported in the U.S. since late March. I think there's a chance that it'll start to tick up again, because there's a lag between when you get infected and when you go to the hospital and when you eventually pass away. At the same time, I don't think the lag explains all of it, probably. And if we're doing a better job protecting nursing homes, there are various theories about what the virus looks like. So there's a lot we don't know, I'd say.
I'm just looking at this Washington Post chart. We're in mid-April, you're talking about 2,000 deaths a day or more than that. And now you're in the range of 600, 500. I know this data is incomplete often, but I think the comparison is useful in that what's happening right now is different than what happened in April in terms of deaths that may, of course, spike back up. We don't know that yet.
Do we know why this is happening right now? Is it just that it was a matter of time once states started reopening before cases came back? I mean, is this bad luck? Does it have to do with decisions made on the ground? Why right now?
So it's a great question, because it doesn't actually line up that perfectly with the reopenings per se. There were reopenings back in Georgia back at the end of April. And people kind of predicted, oh, we're going to have big spikes by the end of May, did not see that at the end of May, and now in June, you do see the types of spikes. But they're not necessarily all that strongly related to which states were more open or more closed. Let's think about a couple of things, right? Number one, it's always more important how people behave than kind of what formal constraints there may or may not be. If people personally feel safe, then things can be closed, technically speaking, and they're still socializing. Conversely, things can be open and people can just not go, right? Before Texas and Florida put restrictions on bars, for example, restaurant reservations were going way down, right? Once people realized, oh my gosh, there's big spread in these areas, people are telling me to stay home. And so if you have a perception that things are personally safe, then that can matter. I think there are some reasons why that perception began to become more common a few weeks ago, right? One might have been that you had this initial round of reopenings and actually all the declarations about, oh, we're going to have huge spikes didn't happen because people were being very careful initially, right? You know, also, obviously, at the start of June, the messaging around social distancing changed, where you had all of a sudden people saying, well, distancing is really important, but we understand these protests are important too, so you're balancing risk. Trump began to hold rallies again. The national conversation moved away from COVID toward these protests and toward the election and stuff like that. You know, the other big factor, though, is also weather. In Houston, Texas, it's too freaking hot to do anything outside, at least in the afternoon, in June, July, August. And so therefore, we have people going from the warm, pleasant, outdoor, full spring in the South and the Southwest indoors to air-conditioned environments. By the way, air conditioning itself, the way it circulates air, there are some suggestions that that may be a vector for spread as well. So it's kind of the combination of climate and people letting their guard down.
All right. So we've laid out here some of the reasons why the numbers are ticking back up potentially in the South and Southwest. And so now these states, which are more frequently governed by Republicans, are trying to respond. President Trump still doesn't wear a mask in public. So I'm curious, how is this presenting itself in Republican politics at the moment? How are senators and governors and the president and vice president reacting to this resurgence?
So you've seen over this last week, particularly, Donald Trump is not wearing a mask, kind of dismissing what's going on to some extent. But Mike Pence over the weekend was talking about people should wear a mask. You've seen governors who, I think the governor of Texas was saying, you know, to some extent, maybe we opened up too early. You're hearing Lamar Alexander talk about wearing a mask. So I think the messaging on the Democratic side was always wear a mask. The virus is very serious. We had to stop its spread. I think you're seeing more of that from Republicans as well. So I think this is now changing. And it's not, you know, whether they were wrong in Texas or Florida or Arizona in the first place is different. But other thing is, like, if you saw early on, a lot of Republican governors were saying not only did they were discouraging sort of mask use, but they were in general saying cities cannot be more restrictive than the state is. They were kind of preempting cities from doing more than the state was. And now they've kind of backtracked from that. The governor of Arizona is now saying a city can have a mask restriction even if the state itself doesn't. And that's important because a lot of cities are run by Democrats themselves, and if the cities are more restrictive and more focused on mask wearing, for example, that is going to affect a lot of people who live in those cities. So I think we're seeing over the last 2 weeks, I would say, is a shift on the Republican side that probably includes everybody but the president.
You know, politically, I think it's interesting to see Connecticut, New York, and New Jersey banded together in a sort of, I guess, a blue state coastal coalition and said, listen, if you're coming from these, what was it, six states, we're going to ask you to quarantine. Obviously, you can't really enforce that quarantine well. But I do think it speaks to the frustrations that certain states have with, frankly, these red states that are now experiencing spikes in cases. You know, the narrative around New Jersey, Connecticut, and New York all doing this quarantine is, listen, the people on the East Coast have been putting in the at-home work, and we are irritated with these states that sort of didn't take things seriously, let's say, 6 weeks ago. So you'll drive around the New York area and see, please call whatever 511 to check and see if you should be quarantining if you're coming in from out of state, which is interesting.
I mean, I do think a lot of people have gone with the theme that this is happening in red states and among Republicans. There is some evidence that Republicans are wearing masks less often. That may be partly because they live in areas that are more rural, but probably once you control for that still, and are a bit less gung-ho about distancing. At the same time, this is actually spreading now in quite a few states, and it isn't that well correlated with political views of those states, right? Nevada, for example, has issues right now. California has a fair amount of issues. There are places like Oregon that were not hit hard before and come from a very, very low baseline. So the absolute numbers aren't high, but the rate of increase is pretty high. And then states people are concerned about, Florida, Arizona, to some extent Texas, are kind of purple states as much as they are red states, and some of the spread is in kind of more urban areas, which are bluer in these states, right? So, like, the notion that this is just all these yokels in red states, I think, is kind of aligns with the data, but not as well as people assume. With that said, clearly it affects the politics of it. For example, if you have all of a sudden now Texas, right, let's say they want to shut things down, let's say hypothetically that Florida and Texas and Arizona when I keep something shut down until September, when it's cooler again, you can start shifting things back outside. Well, if the stimulus package runs out in July, then, you know, maybe all of a sudden now senators from those states, representatives from those states are more interested now in having more continued stimulus, and we'd see how that might play out in the Congress. So it definitely affects the, by the way, a lot of these, because they are purple actually and not red, they're also relevant electorally, as we'll talk about in the next segment, but there are a lot of implications for sure.
Yeah, I mean, a recent piece in The Atlantic argued this exact thing by Ronald Brownstein. He wrote that the Sunbelt spikes could spell disaster for Trump politically in those areas. Is there reason to believe that the severity of an outbreak or the mitigating efforts that states have to take do change that state or affect it politically? Have other places with bad outbreaks moved away from Trump?
I mean, I think some of the Sunbelt guesses make a lot of sense, that if an outbreak becomes particularly bad in a place like, you know, Arizona is the Florida of the West in the sense that it has a lot of retired people. It has a lot of older people. As we're going to talk about, Trump is sort of losing support with older voters. And, you know, you can make some pretty educated guesses about why that might be. Older people are obviously more adversely affected by COVID-19. Their lives, even as younger people go back to relative normal, their lives will be quite abnormal and isolated for a long time. And I think that there is, there's anger at the handling of the pandemic. So you could see, you know, places in the Sun Belt that have a lot of retirees. Obviously, those places have a lot of younger people. I mean, places in the Sun Belt are sort of, I think they're, you know, among the top sort of cities that younger people move to. But also, if you think about voting populations in those states and blocks of people, that kind of makes a lot of sense that a big outbreak in a place like that would have adverse electoral effects. Obviously, I should stipulate that's not my first concern. It's like, you know, old people being scared of dying, as we all are. But I do think that the politics of this year are so, you know, we've talked about it before with the old age of the candidates and now, you know, the prospect of more imminent death because of COVID-19 and people who are older. I mean, it kind of raises the stakes, I think, for people in this pretty stark way. So it's not great to have an outbreak, but it's also not great politically, I would say.
One thing I would add on the politics of it is, I'm not sure for rank and file voters, Democrats, Republicans, or even elected officials, how much the divide is. I'm not sure I could prove Greg Abbott is handling the outbreak much worse than Governor X is a Democrat. What I would say is that Donald Trump himself is very important here in that I think if Donald Trump's message was listen to the health experts, maybe this is the year in which you don't get to go to bars very much. Americans, young people, old people, going to a bar this year indoors is maybe something you should reconsider for these next few months. You can drink the rest of your life, just not 2020. Like that might be sort of a message worth hearing.
And I'll point out you can drink at home.
You can drink at home. And if maybe Donald Trump said it and Fauci said it, then Greg Abbott could say it and Doug Ducey could say it and Ron DeSantis could say it. And so could, for that matter, Jared Polis and so on. So I do think the Trump effect here means the Republican elected officials are sort of nervous about being out in front and sounding too liberal compared to him.
Not separate from politics, but the one thing that I have thought a lot about is how the way we live in different states, suburbia versus urban environments, like New York al fresco dining versus like air-conditioned suburban Texas, like strip mall restaurants, which I love, but like those are different experiences. All of this stuff, it's not just the politics of the state. It's like the literal ways that we go about our daily lives is very, you're kind of caught out by how just lifestyle affects this stuff too, and lifestyle affects your politics, your political approach to this disease, because it, you know, if you live in a place where everyone shops at BJ's and you can distance in the aisles versus like going to the bodega and like you got to wait in line outside in order to make sure that only like seven people are in the store at once, that does affect your perception of the disease. It doesn't really have to do with the politics so much as just America has a lot of different lifestyles. And how, I think it started as a city disease, as an urban disease, and I'm not sure suburban America has adapted to that yet.
I do want to move on because we have a lot of polls to talk about. Claire, what's the saying? Live polls.
Live polls. No one has made this t-shirt yet, and I really want it to happen.
What's the t-shirt?
You know, well, I have to explain the joke. Because the t-shirt would have, like, you know how at strip clubs, usually it has a big sign that points, the arrows are pointing to live girls, or, like, live nudes or whatever? This one would have live poles, kind of like a Vegas-style sign.
This is what Claire wants 538 to sell as merchandise.
Just try to keep it lowbrow here, guys. I think that, you know, there's too much highbrow stuff happening here on this podcast. We need to get a little lower brow.
Okay, so there were a lot of polls, live polls, that came out last week, so let's talk about them. Last week, we probably got the clearest picture on a state level of what the race looks like. And that's because both the New York Times and Fox News, as well as some other pollsters, released high-quality polls. In fact, New York Times has an A+, according to our pollster rankings, and Fox News has an A-, according to our pollster rankings, released polls of swing states. And Biden led in every single swing state in both of those polls, including in Fox News' poll in Texas and Georgia, although the lead there was within the margin of error. And the race for the Senate also looked really bad for Republicans. So let's dig into all of that. And let's start by asking a question that we like to ask from time to time: good use of polling or bad use of polling? So in response to all these polls, the L word came up a lot last week, being landslide. So CNN published an article titled, "Donald Trump is facing the prospect of a landslide loss." Newsweek also published an article that said Trump's dire week of polls shows him headed for a landslide loss. Is it too soon to be talking about a landslide when it comes to the 2020 election? Is that a bad use of polling?
I don't think it's a bad use of polling, because I think that is a good sense of where the data is right now is a relevant question. And I think right now it points to a landslide. I do worry that American readers, news consumers, are not electoral experts, and they get in their heads that the media is saying it will be a landslide in November for sure. And I think that those articles are saying it is a, looks like a landslide at this moment, but things could change. Trump is at a low moment, but his numbers could improve. The country seems like it's falling apart. Of course, people think the president is a bad situation. So I think it's a good use of polling. While I'm always nervous about, are we doing a good job communicating uncertainty and how far the election is from today to the readers. And I'm always sort of nervous about that for 538 and for everybody else too. That's just like a general art. Like in 2016, it was the evidence was there that Trump could win. People didn't necessarily read it that way. And I hope we're communicating that well.
Yeah. I feel like you get in a, well, actually conversation with someone where they'd bring up like the big landslides of the 80s. And I kind of think, you know, we don't really live in a landslide election country anymore. And my part of me says, like, well, first of all, these Times battleground state polls are getting a lot of attention. And obviously, it's a single poll. And, you know, there's, what, 4 months to go to the election, 5 months to go to the election, and things will probably revert a little bit. But Trump was impeached 6 months ago. And we hardly ever talk about that. Now, I don't think the pandemic is at all the same thing, because I think that is going to be a part of our lives for a long time. But I do think that sometimes in politics, we mistake our immediate emotions. You know, those feelings of immediacy are not going to be what we're feeling in 6 months from now. And if we've learned anything, it's that Trump introduces a high level of uncertainty and chaos into politics, to his detriment and to his benefit electorally, I guess, at certain points of time. So that's my point. My other thing is, like, this is speaking of bringing the podcast a little more lowbrow, my immediate thought upon seeing that, like, ream of New York Times polling, like live polls, was how much money did they spend on this? Like, how much money are they spending on polling this election? It's like really quite, they're doling it out.
Yeah, a lot of singles thrown at those live polls.
Yeah.
Okay, so does your vote come down on the side of good use of polling or bad use of polling? It sounded like bad use of polling.
No, I think it's like good, but it's, you know, I do think that there's this interesting thing where, like, listen, I'm a hearty New York Times reader and consumer, but a lot of political media is driven by, like, whoa, what did the New York Times lead with? Whoa, what was the Daily's, like, podcast about? And, like, it's a poll among polls. And, like, to their credit, they are doing battleground state polls, which I do think is, like, very good. But also, the reason why it got so much attention and why, like, Chris Haliza writes about it is because it's, like, a big New York Times joint. And so, not grain of salt so much as, like, yeah, this is interesting, but not, like, it's also June 29th, and we haven't even had the conventions yet, you guys. So, yeah. You know, it's super interesting. Don't get me wrong. I think it's good use of polling. I don't know. I'm not the authority on that. Nate?
All right, yeah, Nate. Can we use the word landslide in June 2020?
You can look at a landslide as one possibility, because it is a possibility. It's always a possibility that what's happening in the polls currently will also happen in November for the whole Democratic primary. Joe Biden was ahead until Iowa, at least. People were like, oh, Joe Biden won't win, and then Joe Biden won. And the candidate in second place, Bernie Sanders, was in second place. So, yeah, it's a possibility. Is it the most likely possibility? I'd probably say not. Can Trump still win? Of course he can. Yeah, look, I mean, obviously when news organizations do polling, they tend to pretend that they're the only polls in the world and promote their polls a lot. Some news orgs are better or worse about it than others. The New York Times in general is a place where, like, when the New York Times does something, the New York Times is going to make sure you knew that the New York Times did it. And so those polls get a lot of attention, but they are also really good polls. They are A-plus rated polls. This partnership between our friends at the Upshot at New York Times and Siena. And you haven't had that many rigorous, high-quality polls in some of these states, like Pennsylvania, for example. And so I think it was a good use of polling on balance.
And so, you know, something that Claire mentioned and something that you alluded to is the possibility for a reversion to the mean. This is something we talk about all the time on this podcast. But if you look back at presidents' approval ratings throughout history, which you can do on 538's website, where we show Trump's approval rating, it's not, like, always a story of mean reversion. Sometimes the bottom just falls out, as was the case with George W. Bush, as was the case with George H.W. Bush. And the situation in the case of H.W. was a recession, and in the case of W. was, I guess, the war in Iraq, Hurricane Katrina, and then a recession. Sometimes the bottom just falls out, and there is no mean reversion. So, considering that we're in a pandemic that is going to be affecting our lives through the election, I think we can safely say at this point, is there an argument to make that we should be considering the possibility of a bottom falling out just as much as we should be considering a reversion to the mean?
Sure. I mean, no one's ever going to want to, like, talk about that because, you know, the incentives are all to be, oh my God, you know, the polls, can they even be trusted anymore, right? And it is June, and fundamentally you should be pretty careful, right? But yeah, there's a possibility that, like, Biden could win by more than he is ahead currently in polls. That's possible. I mean, I think Clark earlier mentioned, like, we're kind of no longer in the era of electoral landslides. I mean, that's kind of an open question. When you have more partisanship now, there are fewer swing voters. And so, like, so, you know, if Herbert Hoover were running for re-election today, although back in the 20s, 30s, he actually did have fairly high polarization then as well, right? But would a 20-point landslide in an era of low polarization translate into a 12-point landslide today or something? Maybe it's something like that. I'm not sure exactly. But sure, I mean, if the pandemic is out of control again, because remember, Trump's numbers are getting worse during a period when things were getting gradually better on the coronavirus front, and now they're getting worse again. Maybe they'll get better again by November. But, like, yeah, the possibility that this thing just sticks with us all year, or at least through the late fall, I mean, that's a pretty negative development for Trump, especially because we kind of condition the economic stimulus on kind of this notion implicitly or explicitly that, like, okay, well, we'll have a wave in the spring, and then by the summer, then it'll be over, or we'll have said, screw it, and we're going back to normal again anyway, right? The second possibility is still possibly true, but, you know, if you have people afraid to spend money in the economy, whether things are open or not, and there's no more stimulus, right? What you don't want is to be is a restaurant that has no customers and also no stimulus. That's what you could get, for example, in states where there's currently bad spread. And so it's just kind of all a big mess. And by the way, anytime you lower expectations, that creates a chance of a comeback later on, right? Expectations are now pretty low for how well Trump will do, which could make, you know, closing the gap from 9 points to 6 points seem, oh my gosh, Trump is making a comeback, right? But yeah.
So just looking at some numbers here, Trump's approval was 42 most of 20, around 42 most of 2019 early this year. So it's down to 40 right now. So George W. Bush ended at about 30% approval. So if I had to bet, my bet would be more, is that Trump's approval is more likely to be 42 than 29 on election day. But is there a case for it being 35? I think that actually could be, where there's sort of a gradual, slow dropping off point, but at the end of the day, it becomes fairly noticeable. We sort of keep tracking, and it's 36, it's 37, it's 35. That seems to be in the range of possibility, because I think you're seeing a lot of Republicans sort of at the elite level kind of jumping off and saying, I've had enough of this, I'm breaking with him. And I think it's getting easier to do that, as not only it looks like he's going to lose and people want to be off a losing ship, and also because he's doing things that are getting more erratic than they used to be, like the Tulsa rally, the things he's saying, the tweets over the weekend. All these things individually don't matter. All these things together might give people, Biden is sort of not being interesting, and he's not saying a lot of controversial things, which if you're a Republican means maybe I can skip this election. So I keep saying this every week, so I'm boring people who've heard me say it before, but I do think there's a case that the landslide is worth considering, because Trump is getting slightly more unpopular, and maybe that continues until Election Day, where Georgia and Texas are actually winnable states for Biden.
The landslide scares Republicans when they're talking about the Senate. You know, you could say, fine, we lose, Trump loses narrowly, but we keep the Senate. When people start to feel freaked out about like what they perceive to be a safe chamber, then I think you start to see a little bit more self-preservation kicking in, and the things that people say, you know, behind closed doors kind of making it into the open air. The al fresco, if we're talking about our dining situations in COVID-19, you can see a lot. Like take the bounties that the Russians have apparently been putting on American soldiers' heads in Afghanistan, and you know the story broke and kind of doesn't reflect super well on Trump, because you remember how he's friends with Putin, and you could see Trump potentially getting in front of some microphones and saying some ill-advised complimentary things about Putin, who's trying to, you know, what, get a faux referendum passed in his country so he can stay president for life, basically. Like, you can see there being another, like, mini-scandal that sinks Trump's approval numbers even more, and that makes establishment Republicans, you know, smack their heads in despair even more. Like, there's lots of stuff he could do. I can't imagine scenarios where Trump does stuff that shakes people's sort of belief in his leadership abilities even more. The economy, you know, you look at those polling numbers, and people are still sort of more approving of his handling of the economic state of things. But if we get, you know, if these waves of illness continue to come, what does that mean for the U.S. economy? Nothing good, right? So even that is a very, you know, it's a foundation of sand.
You look at these polls in Iowa and Georgia, and that's a big story to me, is like these Senate polls. Like, if I did not think the Democrats had much of a chance, I would have said it was below 50% the Democrats win the Senate before. I think it's probably, in my view, closer to 50-50 now. And my reason I say that in part is, It looks like in Iowa, Biden is doing pretty well, and the Senate candidate is doing pretty well, though. The Ossoff numbers in Georgia, it looks like the Democrats will be competitive. I wouldn't say they're going to win those states, but the map to the Democrats winning the Senate is a lot clearer. Arizona, Colorado look like their wins for sure. North Carolina is very competitive. Maine's very competitive. Montana is very competitive. I do see that. I mean, I do think the landslide scenario matters a lot, because a landslide in which the Democrats also get 52 Senate seats is a really big story for governing, for policy, for the country.
Yeah. I think I still have, you know, I'm thinking back to 2016, and there was a period of time where there are tons of news stories about how Clinton was going to win in this potential landslide. And I do remember us talking with some Democratic strategists off on the sidelines about, I don't know, we're maybe nervous about certain places or certain demographics more than those stories might indicate. So I'm always a little bit, that stuff is kind of in the back of my mind. And with this election, I don't think, you know, I think Trump's performance and leadership will continue to be doubted by people. To me, what the big question marks with this election It's turnout in potentially a largely vote by mail election. It's confusion about the administration. It's, oh, do more people register? Like, well, does Georgia, this potentially new swing state that did have a big uptick in voter registration, will something really unprecedented happen there with new people voting? I don't know. There's so many unknowns about the administration of this election. That to me is kind of this, it's both boring and fascinating because no one likes to think about the actual way that we write in ballots and cast paper. But that makes a huge difference this year, and it's where there's tons of litigation going on.
So I think it's important to emphasize the polls are of an electorate. We're assuming people get to vote. We're assuming they get to vote in a fair process. They're assuming a composition of the electorate that'll mean that minorities get to vote and everybody gets to vote in the way they have before. So obviously, if like there's some reason that the voting process itself is disrupted, that's going to mean the polls are all off in a certain way. So that's definitely worth thinking about. I would say though that the numbers suggest Democrats right now should not be as worried about new voters or voter registration or that kind of thing, because the data we have now suggests Biden is doing well among the sort of traditional pool of voters. Like Biden is doing much better than Clinton among seniors, among people who are 65, among white seniors particularly. Like his numbers among black voters are not particularly great. His numbers among minority voters are sort of fine. Like he's doing much better among sort of whiter and more conservative to some extent and older voters. I assume there's no Republican way to like write the rules of voting that will bar white seniors from voting, because most people will vote for the Republicans. But I think that factors the way Biden is winning right now is a way that is like, to me, sort of makes it hard to sort of rig in any way to make it harder for Biden to win, assuming everyone gets to vote again.
Yeah, that's one of the takeaways from the kind of onslaught of polls that we saw last week, was the particular parts of the electorate that are shifting towards Biden and how that's affecting individual states and therefore the gap between the national polls and the Electoral College. Nate, I'm interested in your takeaway after last week. Is there still a gap between the national polls and the tipping point state, i.e. the state that would win Biden or Trump the Electoral College?
Well, maybe a bit less than people would have thought a year or so ago. One set of states where Trump is clearly losing more ground, it seems, than he is nationally, is in these white working class upper Midwest states. So Wisconsin, Michigan, a little bit less clear what's happening in Pennsylvania, but it's kind of often lumped together with that group, as well as Florida. I think because Biden is doing relatively well among older voters, whether it's related to the pandemic or not, or just because older people like Joe Biden, not entirely clear. But like those four states, Florida, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, are probably the four most important states for the Electoral College. And so if that's where Biden's made more gains, then it probably has narrowed that gap a bit. These can be pretty swingy states too, because remember, if you have the election today, then if the polls are kind of even remotely close, then Biden wins by a lot, right? So the Electoral College map doesn't matter. What happens though, if things shift back toward Trump, maybe those states they can be swingy, elastic as we call it. They might shift back a fair bit. But yet, Biden's coalition now looks like kind of a hybrid of Obama's coalition in 2008, 2012, which performed quite efficiently in the Electoral College, versus the Clinton coalition of 2016, which did almost as well in the popular vote, but obviously a disaster for Democrats Electoral College-wise. So the fact that Biden's doing well a little better among older whites and working class whites, and maybe actually not as well as Clinton among Hispanics, for example, that may actually be better for Democrats in the Electoral College than the 2016 version.
So one question that we talked a decent amount about in 2016 was whether the people who really weren't into Clinton during the primaries came around to her during the general. Is there any indication from the polling that we see so far that Sanders supporters, or supporters of any other candidate for that matter, are coming around to Biden and now planning on voting for him in higher numbers than, say, they voted for Clinton in 2016?
I mean, there aren't that many Sanders supporters as compared to 4 years ago, right? Which means you might not expect, because now the Sanders supporters are more diehard as opposed to like all the people who oppose Clinton, you know, he might not do as well as a share of Sanders supporters, but still, does this make sense? This is like getting very mathy, right?
Yes. That the Sanders supporters are a smaller group of people, so Biden can win more votes, but still win a smaller portion of the Sanders voters. Is that what you're saying?
Right, yeah. But look, I mean, the very fact that you, since coronavirus and all these other stories, the protest, you haven't seen as much infighting, because usually you would have months and months of recriminations about, you know, how this primary go and who is reaching out to who, right? You know, certainly it seems like there is very uniform anti-Trump spirit among Democrats and liberals. If you're not pissed off as a liberal about coronavirus, and you're probably pissed off about how Trump has reacted to the protests and, you know, Mike Pence refusing to say Black Lives Matter and the fact that the economy is not in very good shape, to say the least, right? You have a lot to be worried about. And, you know, so I think that kind of has maybe subsumed the usual infighting. You know, no one's going to say that, like, oh, the stakes of this election aren't that high, so we can afford to cast a protest vote, right? No one's going to say that, I don't think, and be taken seriously in Democratic circles.
I would say that I was, just as I was doing a story about black voters, the data suggests that the enthusiasm and predicted turnout levels for Biden are higher for black voters over 45 than under 45. So that's not shocking, but it sort of goes to the idea. There is some, I don't know how well to map on black young voters to Sanders voters, but I think that gives you an indication. So I think Biden has a little less enthusiasm on people under 35. They still may vote, and they will likely vote for Biden, but I think that's a relevant factor here. Like, if you're Biden, the ideal scenario would be that if there's some kind of vice presidential candidate who would excite the people under 35, but not annoy the people over 45 who are the bigger part of the electorate, that would be an ideal pick, of course. I don't think Stacey Abrams, Elizabeth Warren, or Kamala Harris do both those things at once, because I think they might annoy some people older or not inspire people who are younger. But I think that there is some sense of data that Biden is the candidate of kind of the older Democrat. And that's fine. Looks like that might be, even be the better option than having the candidate for the younger Democrat who might be struggling with the older part of the electorate.
Before we go, you brought up the race for the Senate, Claire and Perry. We did get new Senate polling last week along with these state level polls. So I just want to focus in on that a little bit before we go. You know, has it gotten to the point where GOP senators feel comfortable in competitive races, feel comfortable breaking with Trump? And if so, who? Where in, you know, Maine, Colorado, Georgia, Montana, Arizona, et cetera, are we seeing candidates in competitive races start to think that they need to chart their own path?
When you talk to people about Senate races in competitive states, the strategy is always every candidate has to essentially read the room in his locality, right? We talked a lot about this in 2018. Who's embracing the president and who is trying to push him away? You know, like we talked about Martha McSally in Arizona a lot, who is this kind of more establishment Republican, kind of more straight-laced, and she sort of, it was like the awkward hug of Trump, right? It didn't quite sit as well. And I think the calculus in 2020 is potentially pretty different, where people might focus more on the pandemic politics of their state and being sort of a, I'm looking out for your interest in Washington.
So you saw Collins is definitely doing some of the usual dancing away from Trump. She voted against a judicial nominee a couple weeks ago. I think she will, because she's in a state I think Biden will win for sure. So Collins is going to do some of that. I actually think that you're going to see more Republicans in Senate races and House races try to distance themselves from Trump as he gets more unpopular. And I think that's probably a mistake. My sense is that we're in an era in which partisanship and party alignment is pretty strong. And the Republicans are, whatever the morals of this are better off trying to do everything possible to get Trump back to 43% approval, as opposed to saying, Trump is gone, but I'm going to win my race because I'm such a brilliant, savvy politician. In 2018, pretty much every House Republican in a swing district lost. And a lot of them did a lot of dancing to try to show how independent they were, and it didn't work. And so I think if you watch what Mitch McConnell's doing, Mitch McConnell's running. I don't think he's worried about his own race. He's probably going to win his own race. But Mitch McConnell is very strongly defending Trump pretty much at all times. And my guess is Mitch McConnell has thought about the Republican brand itself. He was there in 08 when Bush's downfall took the whole party down. And my guess is McConnell's decided we need to support Trump to get him back to 43 or so that we don't lose every Senate race, which is what they're poised to do right now.
So you're kind of arguing against the idea that people would ticket split at all.
Yes. Yeah. I am suggesting that is less, maybe in Maine. Obviously in West Virginia that happens. It happens in some cases. I think the senators tend to overestimate their ability to differentiate themselves from the president.
I mean, I do think like states like Iowa, where Joni Ernst, who's kind of thought of as a rising star in the GOP, all of a sudden polls show Iowa close. They show Georgia close. They show, depending on who would be the nominee, Kansas close, right? I don't know the Democrats are actually favorites in any of those states, but like those are a little bit of kind of canary in the coal mine types of races where you would imagine that a fairly deep number of Republicans feel vulnerable right now. And, you know, one of the scenarios of the downward spiral for Trump would be if they say, okay, we're actually better off cutting bait and saying, you know, we need you to provide checks and balances against a Joe Biden liberal leftist hegemony that will happen without a Republican Senate.
Did that happen at all in 2016? I'm trying to think about the calculus that you guys are describing between, you know, if Republican senators do break with Trump, then maybe that has the effect of Trump falling further in the polls, depressing Republican turnout even more, and then screwing themselves, the senators, in the long run. So, I mean, how did Republican senators, governors, representatives in the House straddle this when things were looking really bad for Trump in 2016?
If I'm not mistaken, I feel like I'm having a brain fart, but Democrats actually gained seats in the House in 2016, right? Which is a bit unusual for when a party loses the presidency. On the other hand, they had a very bad year in 2014, and so you kind of have a rebound from that. But look, I don't know. I mean, obviously the trifecta is in play this year for Democrats in particular, maybe for both parties, and you know, Republicans have a legitimate concern. Like when we were discussing, like at various points in the primaries, okay, well, what are the chances that like Medicare for All would actually pass? I don't think those chances are as low as we would have thought before, right? I think they're very low because there are not that many senators who necessarily endorse Medicare for All, but like it's possible you could have a giant Democratic majority in the House, 54 to 55 Democratic senators, some of whom are willing to get rid of the filibuster, and Biden having won this, you know, in Georgia and states like that, it's a really blue-looking map, right? Now, parties have famously took in a lot of political capital. Obama in 2008, for example, and not necessarily gotten that much mileage out of it. But if you had that type of scenario, then you might expect Biden and Democrats to squeeze one or two major pieces of legislation out of that. And Democrats have a pretty ambitious agenda for what that might constitute. And so, you know, the stakes are pretty high if you're worried about liberals getting in office and securing a lot of power. I mean, I think Joe Biden might feel like he has a big mandate. It may not be in his personality to push that far. But between the fact that kind of everything is going to be kind of shambles is maybe too strong a word, but like a lot of people's perceptions may be reset. There's a lot of repair work to do on the infrastructure of the economy after COVID. You know, there could be some big changes afoot if Democrats do get this upside, and it remains an upside scenario, not the modal scenario, but the upside scenario of winning by large margins.
One thing I've been thinking about in this regard is it's easy to say this now, hindsight is 2020, but if the Democrats had a well-known, high-quality candidate with a national fundraising base in Georgia and Texas. That would be extremely useful to them right now, as opposed to them trying to like run sort of unknowns and get those people over the line. And so we had the two people who would have been those candidates run for president, and one of them ran for VP and is sort of getting, looks, appears to be getting nowhere close to getting. And I'm referring to Beto and Stacey Abrams. And I do think that those, the Georgia and Texas scenarios are interesting because it looks to me like that Biden is not going to spend a lot of money trying to win those states, and that the party is not going to either. But I think if Beto and Abrams are running, they have their own bases, they can raise money. So I think that's it, because I'm very much right now, the story to me is less, is Biden going to win the election, and more, is Biden going to win this huge landslide? Is an interesting, and I think Georgia and Texas would be the landslide scenario. And to me, it doesn't look, it looks like he might not win those states, in part because the party's not investing that much money in them.
Man, it's rough to be a Gen X Democratic politician this year, who was a big name in 2018. I mean, Beto's campaign manager is now Biden's campaign manager.
Yeah, has anyone heard? Has anyone checked on Beto recently?
I still don't think next year if Biden wins. I don't think he's
Beto's around. He's around.
All right, fair enough. Well, let's leave things there. Thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.